Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue.
Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Unfortunately, Tony is not with us again because he's recovering still from his illnesses. And we hope to have him back soon. But in the meantime, we have a guest interview who we very much appreciate, and that's Sean McNally. And today, there's Sean, he's on there. And then today, we have Dan Larson from the Dan Larson Band. And originally, it was The Keep down that came to the channel and played with many acts, including Mark Ferrana, I think it was the July 30th, 1987.
Right.
And he played many times opening for the Fools, for different acts. But we want to welcome Dan Larson to Two Pints in the Corner. So there you go, Dan.
Thank you so much, Dinky. It's been a long time, buddy. Sure. You haven't changed a bit. You look great.
We're trying our best to stay sober and together. But I wanted to ask you a first question is, do you remember the first time you ever went to the channel?
Indeed, I do.
Oh, let's go on with that one.
I went there. The Drive was playing.
Oh.
And I went to talk with, I brought a little promo package, a cassette. You know, remember them?
Yeah.
Brought a cassette and a really incredibly ridiculous photograph of the band in an envelope, brought it, found the office, dropped it off, called 30 times, 40 times, back and forth, because Dave said, make sure you give me a call. Yeah. And, of course, if you ask me to do that, it's going to happen. So, finally, he called me.
Dave Marsden.
Yes. And they were having a Thursday night show.
No, it wasn't Dave Marsden. It was Dave Mars.
Yeah, Dave Mars.
Oh, it was Dave.
That's right, Sean. Yeah. You're right, yeah.
Yeah, it was Dave. And he says, we're having a local band night. He says, and we'd like to invite you. It doesn't pay anything, but we'll give you a drink or two. So the guys and I said, yeah, it's worth nothing ventured, nothing gained. So we went up on a Thursday night. I remember it was raining like hell. And we got set up. And you, of course, come in and mic'd everything where it was supposed to be. And you told me to step back. Okay. Because I wasn't used to being mic'd and things like that.
Yeah.
And I remember when we got done, we were the first band on, so there's maybe 25 people in there at the most. But we got, people liked it. They liked that because we did all our own stuff at that time.
Yeah.
And we no cover stuff, all our own. And I remember Dave coming out saying, we really like you guys. And he says, when you get done, come back and see me. So when as I'm going back, first thing I heard was, as I'm going around the corner, you know, the bathrooms were on the left, the offices were on the right. So when you made that right-hand turn, I heard Dave talking to either someone on the phone or someone there. No, there's no really good bands from the Cape. We're not going to have any Cape Cod bands at this point. I went, holy crap. So I come around the corner and knocked on the door and oh, come on in, Dan. You guys did great. Here, we're going to have you back again in a month. Here's some tickets that you take and
sell them. Yeah.
You know. And I said, okay. And I remember him saying, Dan, you live close, right? And I went, yeah. And he goes, where do you live? And he's either on his desk or behind him, there was this sheet of paper, and it said Austin Rehearsal. I went, oh, we're from Austin. Oh, right down the road. You won't have no problem advertising to the schools and stuff. And I said, no, not at all. So I walked out of there going, oh, God, I'm going to screw up before we get to play. And I remember we would have rehearsals on the Cape in Falmouth on Wednesday nights. After rehearsal, if we were doing a channel gig, I would go that Wednesday night to Boston. I'd go to Emerson. I'd go over to Berkeley. I would take the little bit of tickets he gave me and make copies.
Yeah.
And I would cut them out by the hundreds.
Yeah.
I mean, I still have them. I would give them to everybody. I'd go over to Berkeley at the Noman desk there and drop them off there everywhere. Remember LaSalle Music? I used to put a stack in LaSalle. I'd put a stack over at Ely Wurlitzer, and we'd have the place packed with people. And Dave goes, how the hell do you do that? I go, and of course, you bring the ticket, and he has to count the tickets.
Yeah.
because that's how you made your $35.
Yeah.
So he'd have a probably 50, 60 tickets. And you know, 50 people at the channel on a Thursday night. That was amazing.
A lot of people.
So, but I also played in there when you couldn't move.
Yeah.
When we did a couple of shows, when we did the Halloween show that time with the Fools and Rick Berlin. Wow. I've never seen so many people in the channel.
Yeah.
You mentioned that before, Dan. That, the Halloween show was one that is still etched in your memory, right? As far as you can say and can't say. But as far as the memories of that gig in particular, because those were quite interesting, to say the least.
Mm.
Well, let me tell you. Okay, so here we are, new kids on the block, all dressed up. I was dressed up as an Army soldier, and my keyboard player was dressed up in a Depends diaper and a device hanging out of the bottom of it. I'll leave it at that. No shirt, flip-flops. But my drummer Ian Elkis was the avant-garde of the band. He was new wave and punk before it was even starting to get out. He had the long piece of ponytail hanging off the back and the short hair. But he dressed up as the most beautiful woman I think I've ever seen in my life. And of course, he's got a skirt on. He has no underwear. We're playing, and the people are going nuts. The makeup, his mom and dad were makeup artists with theater. So when he showed up there, I went, good God, Ian's got a sister? So we're all set up and playing. The place is going nuts. They're throwing shit at us. It's just going all over the place. And Rick and them guys are down the bottom. Everybody's having a blast. The Fools are throwing shit at everybody in the back.
Yeah.
You were there throwing stuff at your corner. And I remember when we were coming off the stage, there was this young man standing by the stage, which I couldn't figure out how he got back there. And he was all over Ian. But he did not know Ian was a man. So, and he comes down and he's got her hand. He's helping her down the stairs. I'm like, holy Christ, we're watching all this. And of course, you know, we'd had a couple drinks. Everyone had a good time. So we go back to the little dressing room, our little one. You remember the one they used to put the ice in the sink? And Ian completely, makeup off, everything off, walked out the door right by the guy. Right by him. And Ian goes to the bathroom or wherever he was going, comes back and walks right by him again. So there's a knock on the door. And I said, can I help you? He says, yeah, the girl that was on the drums, did she leave? I said, oh, yeah, she walked out here a little while ago. We look out, he's circling the club back and forth. But it was just one of those nights where it was just total hilarity. And we were so intimidated because, you know, you got Rick Berlin. Rick at that time was, you know, pretty damn hot. You got the Fools,
really good, yeah,
who have been great since Jesus was in the band. And it was just one of those nights. I mean, the costumes, Dinky. I don't know if you remember any of them, but that night.
The toilet.
Do you remember remember the guy walking around with the plastic plexiglass thing around with the shark head inside?
The washer and dryer?
The washer and dryer. How about the girl with the big 50-pound duffel bags that she blew up with air that became 14-foot-long penises? And trash bags dragging behind it. Oh, my God. But you got to remember, Boston, you've got some of the most amazing colleges in the world with brains. I mean, some of the costumes were just...
Sean, you remember all those costumes.
So, yeah, for me, you got to remember, that was impressionable for us because, hey, here we are from the Cape lying about it, playing at the channel. Oh, and do you remember the little channel down in Mashpee by the name of the Channel 2?
Yeah. You remember that, Sean?
That was like very short-lived, about a year or two, I think.
I used to sweep the... Oh, man. Mr. Boris would pay me to sweep the driveway from the broken glass.
Oh, no.
And...
A gig's a gig.
Well, Sean, here's the best part about it. So one day, one Sunday, when I was in there cleaning up, man, what a place that was. Cleaning up outside, never inside.
Yeah.
I said, do you think one day maybe, you know, when you have one of the bands, maybe I could bring my band and we could play in an afternoon? He goes, you have a band? I go, well, we have a band. We would love to try something, but, you know, I'm still in high school.
Yeah.
I said, but what do you think? He says, I don't know. The only people we have on Sundays is the James Montgomery band. And I went, okay, who's he? Of course, I end up playing guitar with James. But anyway, he says, oh, well, they're a pretty hot band. They're signed to Capricorn Records. And I said, well, He says, let me talk to James. Well, James absolutely wanted nothing to do with it. So we talked to Peter Malick and Peter Bell. And they said, of course, let Dan open up on a Sunday or Saturday afternoon before we play. So a couple months go by, and I checked in every Sunday. About next Saturday, what do you think about maybe a half hour? I went, perfect. All I can say is that half, when I, that whole week of school, I told everybody we were opening with the James Montgomery Band at the Channel in Mashpee. You would not believe how many people came there that were underage that couldn't get in. They stood outside.
I love it.
And I went to school that Monday, guitar god. All for 2 days. That was it. And then James put out his new album, and I was nothing but dust under the cover again. But no, just it's been a – and then to turn around and get a phone call, hey, Dan, you busy tonight? I need a guitar player. And I go, James, if I'm not working, you know you can always call me. So, but I did – done quite a bunch.
You've had the good luck there of having some. I mean, you're a hell of a player, first of all. People do not know who you are. You just send me some of your new tracks. You're still a hell of a blues guitar player.
Really?
Gigged all over the place. You play with some. You mentioned some of the icons, some Channel lore, like The Fools, like James Montgomery. You opened it for Mark Farner. You also did some stuff with Rick Derringer, right?
Ricky was one of my dearest friends in the whole world. And the loss of Rick a couple of months ago really stunned everyone, because Rick was one of those guys. He was a lot like Mark. He taught you the things of what not to do.
Yeah, Ricky, don't lose that number.
And Ricky was such a phenomenal guitar player. Rick anatomically took a guitar apart.
Oh, yeah.
He could, the things he could do, I still have never heard anybody that can do the national anthem on guitar like Rick Derringer. Nobody. And I toured with Rick many, many, many times. I just did a show, a reunion show with his other band, with Tommy and Charlie, Torres, who was, of course, played with Edgar Winter and Meatloaf, everybody, my God. Yeah. And Tommy Curiel, who was with Johnny Winter when Johnny passed away.
Yeah.
And I had just done a show with them at the Larcom, not 2 weeks before that.
Oh, wow.
And they all got together. We did a big reunion show. His daughter was there. It was really nice. I did all the Rick Derringer guitar stuff. And Rick was not an easy guitar player to
emulate. No.
And his stuff was so precision and more signature. It took me quite a while just to learn the nuances of how he bent and did things.
Yeah.
But Rick was, I did many, many shows. The last thing that we did together with Rick, together was me and Rick and Pat Travers. We did the Guitar Slinger Tour. Sold out every show we did. The end of the night jam was like nothing. It was three of the loudest guitar players. We would burn the tables in the front. It was so loud, but people just absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And it was a pissing contest. We could see who's going to outdo who every night.
Every night. I know that one.
Yeah, we did that at Daryl's house, too, down in Pauling. We did the same thing there. And, of course, the tables are right there. And people just, we blew that place apart. I don't know how the speakers and everything, but it was a fun night. I'm standing there with two of my dearest friends in the world, and you're getting elbowed to do your solo, and then you're getting elbowed to do the other one. Then you're reaching over and grabbing the other guy's guitar, and it's just a lot of fun. Thank you, Sean, for reminding me of that.
Yeah, no, great memories. Like you kind of traveled in that loop. Some of the great players over the years. You know, John Kay. I know you mentioned before. You did a lot of John Caffey over the years. You know, John since before Beaver Brown.
Oh, jeez, right? John and I go back when it was just the Beaver Brown Band, when we used to play at the casino down in Falmouth.
Oh yeah,
I did all the shows with him down there. Musquamica Beach, we did. John's another great, great soul. Great soul, great person. Matter of fact, my Abyssal Plain album has two of the songs on there that he wrote and gave me.
Oh, wow.
So John and I go back a long way. Good guy. I've done so many. And, of course, we just lost Tunes not long ago. And that's the other thing I wanted to tell you about. We mentioned Phil Green at Normandy. We're in the studio working one night at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and there's this banging on the door. And, you know, Phil, he never wore shoes, always barefoot. So he goes and answers the door, and Jimmy Miller.
Oh, no. Oh. Jimmy. Oh, no.
comes in the door, and him and his entourage are tripping. Literally tripping.
Yeah.
I'm doing my guitar tracks in the hallway at Normandy.
Yeah.
There's
a
mic at the end of
the street,
At one end, Mike at the other end comes in. Denny Lane and him. Denny Lane trips over the cable, knocks the cable out of the mic. It Because you used to be able to, they would come and stay overnight at the apartments upstairs.
Oh, I get you.
So it's 1:30 in the morning. We're doing these guitar tracks. You got these people banging on the door. You got Denny Lane and Jimmy Miller coming in. Jimmy goes, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that to you. I'm sorry, Dan. Don't kill me. I can remember him doing it. They were, and all of a sudden they're looking up. I go, what's wrong? And so I get informed after they're upstairs. And he goes, they're probably doing acid. And yeah, they were. So. But, you know, just being able to do that, and that's the same time that John McCaffrey was doing the recording for Scotty Brothers for Eddie and the Cruisers.
Oh, wow.
So Mike Tunes is in there. He's sitting there with his sax doing nothing. And I said, well, I got this song called Outway Street, and I really, it's got a nice modulation, and it's got a nice key for sax. Want to try it? Sure. So he didn't even hear it. We just jammed it, and he put all these tracks in there. It's still on the original album.
I like it.
So, and that we became friends then, and Mike and I have done probably a couple dozen shows since then before he passed away. And, what a great soul.
Another ace of a guy gone too soon.
Oh, man, let me tell you. And really surprising because he kept himself, for 84 years old, he kept himself in amazing shape.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, he was a staple. You know, of the John Caffrey and the Beaver Brown Band.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you got the movie part, Wendell in the movie and played a great part.
And bringing it back to the channel, they shot that on the Dark Side video.
They shot the Dark Side there. Yeah, I was there for that afternoon of 49 takes. Oh, yeah.
49 takes. I'll be there.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, how about just going there as a guest? Any acts you could, I mean, you're down in the Cape, so maybe kind of a pain to get to Boston, but were there any acts or any shows you remember where you weren't on the bill necessarily, but you just went to see the act, whether it was a friend or someone famous, whatnot?
You know what? I loved Blue Oyster Cult, and there was just something about them being different as they were. I think going to see that show, I think, was probably the turning point for you can get away with being different because their music was different.
Yeah.
You know, and sure. one of the things that I got to do that I think back now, and when I was 15 years old, I grew up in Baltimore, you know, until my parents moved up here when I was about 15 and a half. For my 15th birthday, I got money, you know, so I went and bought tickets to see Jethro Tull.
Uh-huh. Wow.
That was the first concert that I ever attended. That was at the Baltimore Civic Center. And I lived in a town north of there. Well, the only way we could get there was either hitchhike or jump on the freight train.
Yeah.
And the freight train drove about 30 miles an hour all the way down through the shipyards. Out, come out the other side where the Civic Center was, jump off. Every 45 minutes it ran. So here I am. We're in the nosebleed section. I can see Ian jumping around with his leg up, with his flute, with the colorful clothes and stuff, but you couldn't make out more than that. But that was it. That's when I knew then, after hearing the guitar screaming the way it was, I went, I like that. Well,
that's cool.
Lo and behold, many, many years later, I get a gig opening for Martin Barr from Jethro Tull. And if that's not going full circle, nothing is.
Oh, yeah, that's full circle.
And I explained to him what I did. And you know what he said to me? Your parents let you get on a train?
He had no idea.
Excuse me. Your parents let you hop on a train? And I said, yeah, we hopped off. We hopped on, brought us home, dropped us off a quarter of a mile from the house. He goes, I just find it difficult that your parents would allow that. Not about the music or the song or anything. It was the nomenclature of what I did. So, but it was just an illness. You know, I grew up around, you know, country music. My uncle was, you know, guitarist for Tex Ritter. So I got to watch all these country stars and play, and my uncle would teach me a little riff here. And then when he would come back through town, I'd learn another riff there. And it just an illness. That's what my mom used to call it. The illness.
The illness.
Guitars and amps.
Yeah, it is an illness, but it's a good one.
Well, you know, for the longest time, I grew up thinking my guitar was made by the damn company. You know why? Because it kept telling me to turn that damn guitar down. But no, my mom and dad. I just lost them not long ago. They were my biggest fans.
Fans, I'm sure.
And just it is what it is.
You mentioned. You mentioned Blue Oyster Cult. It's funny, you know, I actually saw them, I think it was 83 at the Centrum out in Worcester. One of the greatest things about the channel was, though, how the, with the size in the, you know, the how well it was known across the country, you would have bands, plenty of bands on the way up, right? But you'd also have the bands kind of on the way back down. They used to be arena acts or shed acts, and they came back and they wanted to play some smaller venues. So Blue Oyster Cult would play the channel. And
But they had a different name. Kind of shows just
incredible. They were under a different name.
They had to, because they couldn't legally play on the Blue Oyster Cult because they don't know the rights on it. It was, yeah. It was left, I don't know, left bunk, I don't know what I meant.
I know it was something, left something. But, you know, and it's strange that you say that, because, Sean, the next thing I'm about to tell you about the channel was about the band Quiet Riot.
Oh, sure.
Here I am. Dave's got me all set to play. We're all set. And he goes, calls me up. He goes, oh, Dan, listen, I'm going to have to cancel you. I'm bringing that band Quiet Riot in. They're going to fill your slot. But I'll find you another one. I went, okay, thanks. Golly gee, after we did all the advertising and everything, yeah. 2 days before,
yeah.
Because they were coming through town. Like you said, they were on their way back down the hill a little bit. But yeah. You know what? You mm-hmm. take the good with the bad. You know, I never bothered me. I think probably when you talk about opening acts, I think the strangest opening act I ever had was opening for David Lee Roth.
Oh, yeah.
And that was at the Buffalo Chip in Sturgis. And that was... that. Whoa, man, that was
a trip.
I'm still trying to put a grasp to it. He comes out dressed in this green plaid pants and shirt with a golf cap, you know, with that big smile that looks like the Joker, and he made people wait 45 minutes before he would come out because what happened before then was an act of God. We're on stage playing like crazy, and I noticed the wind starts playing. There's about 35,000 people in this amphitheater. And we're playing, you know, and they're coming in on their motorcycles to see the show, but the wind's really starting to blow. Dinky, what happened next, you wouldn't believe. They had all these Marshall cabinets. I know you've seen them.
Yeah.
Fake ones that are clamped together with the little 9-volt batteries. The whole back is filled, the whole back line.
Yeah.
The wind come through, knocked every one of those amps on the floor.
I love it.
The amps went on the floor.
I love it.
The backdrop, that 108-foot by 80-foot backdrop, blew out over David Lee Roth's bus. Now, I've got my 15-year-old son DJ with me. He's holding my amp with his foot. He's holding, at that time, Skip was playing with me. He's holding Skip's kick drum and snare, and we're not stopping. And when I found out, that was the first time I'd ever heard of the word cyclone. It was a mini cyclone that came through there. And it just knocked everything down.
Yeah, I believe that.
Well, he wouldn't come out until that floor was swept, cleaned, wiped down, and... As a matter of fact, the funny part about, well, it's not funny, but the funny part about it is he just wasn't going to come out. So I'm leaving the owner, you know, Mr. Woodruff. He says, Dan, you and your band don't go anywhere yet. Stay right here. I said, okay. So we got our gear off the stage. And he says, because if he's not out here in 5 minutes, I'm going to have you put your gear back up. And you're going to play the rest of the night. I'm going to pay you what I was going to pay him.
Oh.
And we're talking five numbers.
Yeah.
And I was... But he came out. So. But yeah.
That's a nice story. I like that one.
Well, he's to this day, he's still quite the unbalanced character.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's not balanced correctly. There's
no, it was, that's why they went down the tubes in a way when they left, you know, because he was a spurt with, you know, he was, but he was only part of it. Because the other guys played there.
Well, look at who was in the band with him. He had Steve Vai.
Yeah.
He had Billy Sheehan. He had Greg Bissonette. Christ, you have the best of the best on the planet, and you walk out there and make a total character of yourself. It'll be very nice.
Yeah.
But
wow. Well, I've seen things like that before with different people, even at the channel. You know, I mean, we've had some really interesting acts that came through from England, from Australia, from, you know, different parts of the world. Russia, we had Aero guys came from Russia.
Aerofly, wasn't it?
Aerofly.
Yeah, that was, I remember one. That.
There was some, you know, but Sean has gone through all the, it wasn't just the security guys. He was the promoter with Cringe. I mean, that's what he has right now. But Cringe had all those kinds of acts, the punk bands, the heavy metals, the hardcore. But the hardcore is really what was doing 88, 89 through there.
Yeah.
And bands that were just doing really straight hardcore and posing and stuff. And the good bands like we had with Extreme and stuff. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, even Mass and stuff like that had some great, great stuff
going
on.
We all grew up playing together. That's the greatest part about it.
That's exactly what it is. So it's all flawed with the music that was happening at the channel that time, you know. And,
well, Boston was the epicenter at that time, and a lot of help was WBCN.
A lot of the help was
everybody over at BCN. I mean, everybody. That was the draw. Hey, we're playing in Boston at the channel. We'll go over and see everybody at
BCN.
And, I mean, I sat in a couple of those a couple of times, and those were interesting interviews.
Oh, I should think so.
Oh, yeah.
When there's people that know, like Carter, who wrote the book with me, you know, because he's such a genius when it comes down to memories of that time period and the stuff he really liked.
Yeah.
You know, and it's good to have someone that's still around that does all that and remembers it all. And we could, you know, and Sean remembers the same, if not more, because he was there on nights where you had five people in and 25 people and stuff like right. that. So he saw everything.
Well, you know, you just nailed it. And the thing is, you get the commonality of it is, I myself and my guys, we were so fortunate to, if we played in front of five people at the channel, we didn't care.
It was
the channel.
Yeah.
And the respect that we had for not only, like you coming up saying the first time we played there, I like you guys' original stuff. Well, that was, to us, that was the world. And that simple little comment, which I'm sure you said to many people.
No, it once, you can see so many bands going through, and there's always somebody that night that really can, you know, turn you on kind of thing, the whole music. And you did... You took it to the next level because you had the performance that was really what you're supposed to do. Really put your heart and soul into the performance. The people had never seen you still went, whoa, that is a great performance. That is a great music.
And that's exactly why we continue doing it, regardless through the good, the bad, the indifferent, the whole nine yards.
Still at it.
That's a great.
And I'm still
doing. What both you guys just made. How supportive, and I can tell you this, Dan. Dinky did not pass out compliments like you'd think of like a regular every night. It wasn't like that. He like he said, we were there where there were five, six bands a night, 7 days a week. Sometimes we'd have matinees on a Saturday or Sunday and a show at night. So we literally would see hundreds of bands a month.
Hundreds.
Do you know
to get a compliment was, you know, Dinky's. Like you said, Dickie's is still a world-known, world-renowned engineer, and his sound systems are very famous. And, you know, that's one of the big reasons people wanted to play the channel. It was the biggest club in town, the most powerful PA system, the great stage. The production was untouchable compared to any other venues in the area.
Production was great.
And getting back to what Carter said, you said about Carter, like, there was a very supportive scene. And I'm not going to say it's not these days, but back then, you know, we talked about this before. You could literally go... And we did this. We would go see our friends open up at Bunratty's at 9:30 on a night, and then go to the Rat to catch our other bands at 10:30, and go to the Chandler at midnight for the headliner at 1 o'clock in the morning. You could do that, and it was cheap. It was, you know, $4, $5, $6.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the key.
And the diversity of within like a block, one block of diversity. You'd have blues here. We'd have punk here. We'd have new wave here, and everybody supported everybody.
Yeah.
There was no...
Exactly, having guys like Carter there, who's emceeing, but he's the first guy that played, you know, the Atlantics, Lonely Hearts, the first guy that bought Extreme's Mother Don't Want to Go to School thing.
Yeah. I mean,
these are bands who were playing the channel, packing the channel, and then they really were unknown to the outside the area until BCN got involved, and of course, that caused a wave across the country, and some of those bands became massively popular.
Well, he broke U2 in this country.
I know.
U2 as well.
Yes, he did.
But it also broke up Boston bands that were going out and stuff that supporting them. Some of the bands, the individuals like yourself, but it was the rest of the people that were playing behind were either got day jobs or they didn't want to really travel, they didn't want to do this, that, and other, but they don't mind playing with you at night.
Well, look what you did for the new wave stuff.
Yeah.
The Cars.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, still, to me, one of the most progressively incredible, talented bands ever to play. I mean, you had five or six guys in that program that were completely 100% opposite of one another.
Yeah.
The music they made.
The music was great.
There's not a bad song.
You could see them more at the Rat down there, performing down the Rat.
Yep.
And you were opening probably for them at the Rat, because that was spectacular. And then they'd come over to the club later, like Sean just said. Most of the bands would come over, but also the punters would come over to join you, you know?
When we opened for them, we were like cannon fodder. You know, everyone's wandering around and they're drinking. And then when we started playing, you see the little bit of a change, And that's when Ben and I, that's the first time I met Ben Hoare.
Yeah.
And Ben had told me, he says, you're different.
Yeah.
And I go, is that good or bad? He says, just look at us. And the music of the Cars was different.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you listen to the Cars and you listen to everybody, Elliot is just one of the most underrated guitarists on the planet.
Yeah, he is actually.
And the whole band just brought something completely different together. And look what they did collectively.
Yeah.
That's one of the things.
Exactly.
Ben, quiet and reserved with a thoroughly amazing voice.
Mm.
So, yeah, but that was, boy, now you're bringing back some great memories now.
Yeah.
Except for when my feet.
Reminiscing about the channel.
Except for when my feet stuck to the floor at the Rat. You know, that was always up.
It stuck to the floor at the channel in the front.
Well,
dance floor.
That's why you notice there was always a little gap there, because the floor was always glued together. And I remember, do you remember one time yelling at me?
Probably.
Don't touch that mic.
Oh.
In front of my amp. I said, well, what happened was I kicked it.
Yeah.
You didn't see me kick it by accident. And as I'm putting it back, you said, don't touch that mic. I went, okay.
Well, I'm more worried about electric shocks and stuff from you guys.
Well, we didn't use orange amps then. Remember, though?
No, I had orange built for Fleetwood Mac. I had a whole bunch built. And originally was built with aluminium transformers.
Exactly.
Not transformers, but chassis. And the transformers would be so heavy that the chassis would go bloop and bend in between. And I had to have Fly Matt out, who built them, from Huddersfield. This little gentleman from Huddersfield, all the way to Chicago to fix the ones at Fleetwood Mac on tour in Chicago. And all he did is, like, took a big hammer and...
Yeah, I've seen that before.
And I says, oh, the English way of doing stuff. Bang the damn thing. He says, nah, it'll be all right. Then we'll just remember not to make them out of aluminum anymore. We'll make them out of steel. And that's why they got steel.
They wanted it lighter. That's what it was.
But the problem with any of this is the shorting. Is why when you are touching your microphone and grabbing your microphone and you've got a guitar here, if you're engineer tech guy, or if you haven't done it and checked for electric shocks, you better do it, because we've lost a bunch of guitarists.
You better believe it.
Freeze guitarist.
Yep.
On stage, playing away, and he grabbed the mic and guitar and just fell to the floor and gone.
Some people can't take that shock.
And the little ones, as you know, your nose, your mouth, and everything.
Oh yeah.
But it's not. Once you've got that, you're actually in between the mic. If you touch the mic and the guitar, then you are gone, because it is, especially if you're doing 250 volts, you know. But with 110, you got a chance.
Well, a lot of overseas is 250, that's
right. Yeah, and if you've got a 250 in England, 230, 220 sometimes in Europe.
That runs a dryer. That tells you how strong that is.
But that's what you got to use. And that's the power amps. The old transformers are all built to that. The ones that we had built, the WEM stuff, was all little screws in the back that you could take the screw out and put it in another tap, and you tap it and it would go straight into, like, from 110 to 220, and it was all modular and stuff, so they were fine. But you plug the crown in direct in Europe, woof, gone flying, fire, you know.
Yeah, and I've seen an arc jump out one time, 2 feet long.
Oh,
bright blue.
Bright blue.
Yeah.
That's the issues with... even old Fenders, even microphone, old Fender cabinet, Fender amplifiers.
The old twins,
because the old twins didn't have the ground on them.
And if you remember, they also had an extra AC
socket
in the back.
Yeah. And that was the kicker. You always, you plug your effects and all that stuff into that one and whatever. But it still was so dangerous on stage and what have you. And even to this day, I wouldn't go on a wet stage and this, that, and the other. I've cancelled more shows on when I was on tour that's wet stages. I wouldn't have people come on, although I've played on wet stages when the rain's blowing in and stuff, and we're all trying to go further back, and as we're going further back, people can't see us, but at least
staying dry.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, Sean hit a good note. Sean, when I would go out to NAMM or out to California or anywhere that people knew about the channel, they said two things: best sound system they ever had and the best tech they ever worked with, Dinky Dawson. And I don't know how many. We could be in the middle of nowhere, and they'd hear, "Oh, the channel in Boston, Dinky's still there." I mean, I don't know how, and to this day, people probably think you're still there.
Yeah, I've had more emails with people wanting to play the channel, and I have to. And they don't even go on the website to see that it's no longer
there.
Well,
it's a tribute channel, I know.
It's one of them things. And I've been sending a couple of them up to Sean, you know, over the time. I said, Sean, you might have wanted to do one of these guys on the gig. I was trying to get Sean to put Denny Diaz's band on there, which is a Metallica cover band. And they play Vegas all the time, but I don't know if they're still playing in that particular band anymore. They was playing drums. One of Denny's sons from Steely Dan days, you know. You know, you wouldn't believe it. I said before we sat out in the bus. Actually, went to pay. What was the group, Nancy? The one that from L.A. Suicidal Tendencies.
Oh yeah.
We went into the bus and they got Steely Dan on. There was stuff. I says, "And you playing your wild stuff, and you've got Steely Dan on." He says, "Well, that calms us down, you know."
Well, they were energized.
Oh, there were so many bands that came on right after the thing. The best ones were like yourself that came in there with a mission, and the mission being is to play to people with their heart and love. It's just like I saw your website, and I have to say this because we're going to have to go soon here. I uncovered my passion for music during my first guitar lesson with my Uncle Roy Parks. From that point on, I was involved in the choir, musicals, and songwriting. Life in a song. I follow my dream, I write lyrics, and I produce my songs in my way, my own way. You see, and then the bottom thing is got on there that really, really says all. Be inspired by everything. We find inspiration all around us. We try to make our music and representative of ourselves and our generation. I love the places that most people don't give a second chance. See, that's the channel.
You know, I'm Dinky. I could go anywhere where there's any national acts.
Yeah.
And the first thing they would say is, "Did you play the channel?"
Yeah.
And I go, "Yep, a couple dozen times."
It's amazing how many people remember that from the bands from the past.
Well, I said this to Sean earlier. I said, you know, with all of the people, you know, you had forgotten about the Keep part. And I said, you didn't forget. I said, it's just there's such a gap in time.
Oh, yeah.
And then I said, with all the people musically that you've been involved with throughout all the years, I'm still stunned that you remembered me.
No, I remember the playing. I remember what you did. And then I listened to the new stuff that you sent me, and I'm saying, wow, you really progressed in a different level, and you really got the heart going off. And then when I saw this on the website, I says, yeah, he's totally got it. And with the people around you that you have, the people you're playing with, and all the people you mentioned here that you played with and you play still with once in a while, that shows to me that you've got still the heart and the spirit in this. It's called music.
And I've created an open door for people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'll get questions. I never fail to answer any questions. A lot of people make comments about my guitar tone and what do I use and how do I use it. And I'm old school.
Yeah.
You know, I'm...
Turn it on, boom.
Plug, play, run, hit. I mean, like before, we used to call it cannon fodder. Get off my stage. We'd get done. Get off my stage. Yeah. I played with Southside Johnny a couple of months ago before he retired. And I got to get up and do a handful of his hit songs with him. And it was probably one of the top honors of my life because Johnny's a tough guy.
Man. Oh, yeah.
But he has got the heart of gold.
And his performance is unbelievable.
Amazing. I mean, he comes up to... It's funny how he does it. We're all done with the opener. So he runs over behind the stage and he sees me standing. He goes, if I may be blunt, where's your effing amp? Where's your effing guitar? And I'm like, my tech put it away. Get it out. Get it out now. So they go over, pull my guitar and amp and everything out, plug me in. I get up and get played. We did three or four songs together. It was just,
yeah.
I mean, that's spontaneity.
Yeah.
Your amp and guitar is put away.
Yeah.
But he brought me up. I never have played a song with him in my life. We did all those songs by memory.
Memory, yeah. The thing that's interesting is that if you're in a record contract today, most of those record contracts is that they don't like you to go to play with other people.
Yeah.
Whereas we used to play with everybody.
Everyone.
It was wonderful. You remember that, Sean.
Of course.
And the thing is that today, with all the corporate stuff, it makes the music less inviting. And that's why the music is stagnant that's out there. And then when I heard this new stuff that Dan's done, I'm saying, whoa, this is the ride on. This is great stuff because it's real. It's real. It's not Memorex. It's not put in the studio and one thing saying yes, and it's repeated 50 million times by the computer.
Well, you also hit on the fact that, you know, I'm environmentally, you know, I write about everything, whatever it's around me. I mean, my song Shuffle Dog, that was about my little dog, you know, my little pug that I had. And the thing is, it was... When I would play, she would do the little dance. I mean, I'm giving away, yeah, but I mean, it feels good to me. And for some reason, it seems to, you know,
it's universal.
Appeal to other people. So
it's universal. Anyway, we're just about finished here right now, but we're going to go another day on this at some point because Dan's got a lot going, Sean.
I appreciate it. We could definitely talk for longer. Maybe have another episode, like you said. But Dan, I really appreciate you joining us today and kind of sharing some of those great memories from the channel and the old support scene, the Boston rock scene back then.
Yeah, Sean, I am honored to be sitting in this room with this man. We go back a long, long way. It's good to know that, you know. I mean, we're losing so many great people. Yeah. This guy here is the toughest guy since nails, and and I just hope he stays around another 100 years. I'll be here with him.
100%.
And you're getting up there these days. I'm up there, but you're getting up there.
Yeah, well, my birthday is next Sunday. And by the way, that's the night of the New England Music Awards, which I'm still in. All of us are kind of chuckling at the fact we, I was nominated for a Boston Music Award many, many years ago with a country act, which was not me, but her. And it was fun going to the Orpheum and seeing, but I never really, you know, put, you know, much emphasis because I didn't think people paid attention. Then I find out we were nominated for Best Blues Act of 2025. I mean, I'm in with some great people. Johnny A, I mean, all friends. I mean, Johnny and I, we've all grown up again through the channel and everything else. It's such a collective circle of great players.
Yeah. Well, here we go. I just wanted to say before we end this, we're recording this on November the 5th. And the reason I mentioned that is because where I come from, I'm just about to burn Guy Fawkes on top of my bonfire and have some candy apples and some fireworks and set him off because it's Guy Fawkes night in England. And I just love it. I just love it that unfortunately you can't do any of that stuff here because Guy Fawkes didn't try to blow up the Houses of Parliament here because there ain't one. And the thing is that this is also the night that... The night before is called Mischievous Night. And that was, you know, what happened here in America with Halloween and the night before Halloween and this, that, and the other. But but we have it in England where it is Mischievous Night. And I used to go out when I was, like Dan, a little kid, and go out and watch my friends play in the local bar and have a great old time watching Pete Fender and the Strollers or Dave Berry and the Cruisers. Vance Arnold and the Avengers. That's actually Joe Cocker. So, you know, I grew up with all the kids. All of us are friends and stuff that from the past. And I just have to say, Dave Berry's at 90-something, and he's still playing the same gigs. He's playing up at Wentworth and in the pub, and having a great old time. And he was very popular in New Yorkshire, where I came from. I mean, he just sold out everywhere. And I made a nice career from him. He's actually from Hawaii originally, and he's 6'4" Hawaiian, and he's a great guy. All right, Sean, I want to just say thank you again, and thank you there to Dan here, and we'll do Dan again another day, and because he's got so many more better stories than I thought he had. Just keep him.
So, well, guys, it was a great show.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you for listening to Two Pints in the Corner, and this is it, closing out.